You're listening to Ask a Black Doctor, Friday Facts About COVID-19 featuring Dr. Bukasi Dubé. Join us every Friday at 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. for a half an hour as we discuss issues surrounding the current pandemic, vaccines and distribution, dispel myths, provide facts, and address concerns. We'll also be providing updates about COVID-19 vaccines and discuss how we can build a better culture around Black health. Episodes will be available wherever you listen to podcasts, so head on over to thenumbers.fm for the link to the show. Now let's jump into it.
We want to thank you for tuning into another episode of Ask a Black Doctor. DJ Ambush here with Dr. Bukasi Dubé. You know how we do? We get together every single week to bring you the latest and greatest information in the medical community with what we're all struggling with right now, the COVID-19 pandemic. Doc, how are you this week?
Man, I am doing well. It's been a rough week. I wasn't feeling too well early on last week. I think we talked about that the last episode. I'm finally over the hump, and I'm almost 100, not entirely 100%, okay. But I'm almost there.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I am doing really good. I had a breakthrough, not a breakthrough case. I had a breakthrough in one of my habits. So we always talk about how important it is to get good rest.
Yep.
And I'm on a CPAP machine now. So my rest has gotten, you know, increasingly better over the years using the CPAP machine. But there was a habit that I really couldn't break, and it was late night eating. And this is with me knowing that my body has to work now throughout the night to digest because I've eaten so late. So two nights ago, I accidentally had dinner at a reasonable time, and there was like a 3-hour gap.
Accidentally.
And so I'm upstairs about to go to bed, and that late night urge was like, I want to get something to eat. But I was like, I am actually too tired to go back downstairs. I got 6 hours of sleep and woke up feeling like I got 10 hours of sleep.
And nice. I was like,
oh, wait a minute. So then I repeated it last night, and the same thing happened. So it looks like I might be cured of my late night eating.
Well, let's wait until 2 weeks, and then, let's discuss this in 2 weeks.
Because I am addicted to feeling this good after going to sleep. So, yeah. But we have a guest with us this week. Let's introduce the guest, Doc.
Well, today we have the pleasure of engaging Dr. Maria Sundaram, and she's an epidemiologist at the Mashville Clinic, and it's awesome to have you, Maria, please take a moment to tell our guests about who you are and what you do.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on so much. So I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist. I work at this rural clinic in central Wisconsin called Marshfield Clinic. They're a health system, kind of like the Mayo Clinic, so they provide healthcare to rural upper Midwesterners such as myself. And the town I live in is Marshfield, which is 20,000 people. So it's a little bit of a small community, but a tight-knit one. My work is focused on respiratory viruses, and before 2020, that just meant like flu and maybe like a couple other ones. And now it's like 99% COVID. It's like still 1% flu, but you know, there's still some COVID. I am a talker. I'm a big talker, a big extrovert. And so I tend to talk a lot online about how to talk about science. You know, there's a lot of different right ways to do that. So, and you know, here I am talking some more, and you guys are, you know, allowing me to talk, which is awesome. So. Yeah,
so glad to hear you're a big talker. There's a lot to talk about, especially in the area of trusting science during COVID-19. I feel like that was, you know, kind of like the grounding point for the show, and has been a reoccurring theme episode to episode, making sure we can trust them, making sure people understand the medical community is the one to be trusted, not any of the talking heads or the pundits or the politicians or any of that. Please, please trust the medical community. So we started early on trying to dispel different myths that were going on. You know, it took a couple episodes for Bukasi to convince me that there were no magnets in the vaccine. You know, I didn't want to let that go. I was pretty sure about it. You know, then there's the whole 5G thing. So there were some things that we had to sort out. Recently, there was the the conspiracy of Deltacron, and all, it's like there was just, you know, Flurona. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to talk about. So right now, one of the major things we're talking about, where everyone's concerned about, has been the change in the amount of days for isolation and quarantine. So people now only have to isolate and quarantine for 5, not 10 days. What exactly does this mean, and how did we get here?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things going on here, I think. One of them is that, you know, there's all this, like, we normally just think of, like, when you get sick, and then when you get better, you get better. And, like, that's pretty, like, we decide when we're sick because we can feel it, we decide when we're better because we can feel it. And that makes perfect sense. But there is a whole other component of that, which is how it affects other people. And so when you're sick, that doesn't always line up with when you can make someone else sick. You can feel sick before you can make someone else sick in some cases. In some other cases, you can make someone else sick before you start feeling sick yourself. Mm. So you might be feeling completely fine, absolutely nothing wrong, and you've already transmitted something to someone else. You know, just not knowing it. And the same kind of thing happens at the end of your illness. There's like a little bit of a mismatch between like when you might be feeling better and when you like can actually transmit the virus to someone else. So this is kind of like one of the reasons why the isolation period got shorter, because for most people, after this period of time, they're not able to transmit the virus anymore. At least, you know, the genetic material that's in their like nasal passages up in that area where they, you know, they swab the back of the brain, that like uncomfortable area in your like nasal passages, that genetic material can't produce any more virus anymore. It's tired. It's taken a beating from your immune system, and now it's just laying down and giving up. There is another kind of component to this, which is that especially for healthcare workers, there is a really big need to have people in the hospitals and being able to work because there is such a surge of patients across health systems. And Dr. Dubay can talk a lot more about that, I'm sure. But so you know, the CDC is making these recommendations, and they're not mandates. They're just kind of recommendations based on, you know, this first part about how like the length of your illness doesn't always line up exactly day to day with like the amount of time that you can make someone else sick. Plus the fact that specifically for healthcare workers, there's this big need to have people.
Well, so I appreciate that answer, right? Because it speaks to what we've been talking about for a while now. But if I were to play the devil's advocate here, is science being informed by the fact that we need people back at work, or is this really science?
Yeah, and I think that's a good question to be asking. I think the best answer I probably can give, and I'm not trying to necessarily like be pro or anti CDC, the public health recommendations are usually made in an environment that is not the perfect situation that epidemiologists would like to see. In the ideal world that we all, like my colleagues and I, would love to see, you know, everyone, like there's like a vaccine delivery service, like it's like the ice cream man, and he comes around your block, everyone runs out, you get a shot, like that, you know, masks are delivered every day, everyone has paid sick leave, everyone has paid maternity leave, like all of this stuff is really important for public health. Not to get too much on a soapbox, like that is the future that I would love to see. You know, in the real world, obviously, sometimes things are different. And so the recommendations that are sometimes made by CDC, like, obviously, they're as close as possible to what's biologically happening. But also, they have to take into account sometimes the fact that there are, like, real world pressures as well. Actually, a really good example of this is changing recommendations for pneumococcal vaccines. So if you're a certain age, or if you have like some kind of underlying health condition, a doctor might have told you, hey, you should really get a vaccine against pneumonia. That's great, and we really love those vaccines. But for a shorter period of time, this is what feels like a decade ago, but it was much shorter than that. There was a vaccine shortage of pneumococcal vaccines in the US. And because of that shortage, the CDC changed their recommendations to who should be prioritized to get those vaccines. We kind of see that happen in Canada, by the way, with COVID-19 vaccines as well, and elsewhere. So, you know, in the ideal world, everyone gets a pneumococcal vaccine on day one. In the real world, we don't have enough vaccine for everyone on day one. And so we kind of like try to plan for that. And then this is, I think there is a, in my opinion, a component of that is also happening with this shorter isolation period. But you know, reasonable people probably could disagree on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Real world thinking, real world, you know, application to this particular issue is about resources. And the way you framed that earlier brings to mind the conversation around masks in the first place and some of the arguments. Well, at first they said we didn't need masks. Now we're saying we need masks when the actual issue was, you know, the amount of resources and the prioritization of the medical community being able to have masks. So now that we're talking about, you know, the period that people should be quarantined, looking at the way hospitals are being flooded now, We're changing over complete wings. A friend of mine was one of her parents, I believe, was in rehab wing of a hospital. And because of the surge of COVID cases, they had to be pushed out and that entire wing had to be turned over into a COVID wing because Omicron is just so contagious right now. Could either of you speak to seeing some of those changes and the way, you know, you guys are affected now with this surge?
Man, so see, that question highlights why it's important for everyone to do the right thing, right? Because the higher the number of folks who are ending up infected, the higher the number of folks who end up in the hospital, and unfortunately, the higher the number of folks who end up dying. So when our hospitals are full of people who have COVID, and also our staff getting sick, right? So there are two things. One, if you go to the hospital because you are pregnant and you need to give birth, or you have a broken leg and you need that fixed, or you have a heart attack, God forbid, you need a cardiologist or something like that. There's not enough space at the hospital for all these folks. You factor in that the fact that our staff are getting sick from COVID-19 with the current surge, that actually makes things that much worse. You have an increase in number of people needing services and you have a decrease in number of people able to serve them. That creates a crunch for everybody. We have seen people who have gotten sick, more sick than they should have, because they couldn't access the services that they need. So that's why we all need to step up and say, hey, you know, I may not get very sick if I were to get, I'm just using I here as a hypothetical individual. I may not get sick if I were to get COVID-19, very sick if I were to get COVID-19. But if I pass it to other folks who may end up needing services, they create a crunch in the hospital system that affects the entire system. And as a result, people end up dying unnecessarily. People end up staying in the hospital unnecessarily. And we use resources that we don't necessarily have, right? We're having to use extra PPE just to take care of folks who are infected with COVID-19. We end up having to cancel surgeries. We end up having to delay chemotherapy for folks that need chemotherapy. It's not just me thinking about myself, right, as to whether or not I should get vaccinated. It's about thinking about the entire system, right? And so that's why we need to do this, not just for ourselves, but for everybody else.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just some of the situations you described, I think, you know, it's just so crazy to me how many like add-on effects there are once this cycle starts happening, where like we have a ton of people in the hospital who need help because of COVID. We also have a ton of people who really need medical help that maybe don't have COVID, but they've delayed a surgery for a really long time and they've been in pain, or they have cancer and they need chemotherapy, but they're not getting it. And so we're building up this number of people at the same time that we're taking hospital workers out of the hospital because they're all getting sick. now that there are fewer healthcare workers per patient, that also creates like an unsafe environment in the hospital, right? Because you have fewer, just number of people to support healthy, safe care for individuals. And this is, it's like a system-wide thing. It's not just doctors or nurses. This also relates to the housekeeping staff, the janitorial staff, like the cafeteria staff, everyone who works in the hospital, right? The other thing I think that I've also heard is like, you know, well, you know, you can be in a car crash, God forbid, or you could be, you can have a heart attack and go to the hospital. That's not a COVID case. So, like, you're not really affecting the flow of patients. First of all, you know, you are, and you might not be able to get care right away. But let's say, you know, you're one of those people that, like, you haven't started feeling symptoms yet, but it turns out that you are COVID positive. Even though you feel fine, you're still going to need special care in the hospital to protect other patients from you and to protect doctors from you. And so that also kind of makes things complicated. I mean, you're not just there for a heart attack, even though you don't feel like you're sick with COVID. If you're COVID positive, you need special care. So it's just, it's hard, I think, to imagine, because we, most of us aren't in a hospital every day, all day. It's hard for us to imagine how quickly all of that, that like really finely tuned system can get really messed up.
Man, I feel like I'm hearing more cases or more situations about healthcare providers, the lack of resources, but healthcare providers, there being a shortage, rather. And I'm sure some of this is definitely due to how long you guys have been fighting, how long you guys have been going at this. Dr. Dubé told me, I want to say maybe into the fifth or sixth episode, like, it's tiring. Like, we are talking about shifts you guys have had to do, and people getting sick. And now with Omicron being that much more contagious, whereas people may not necessarily be coming down with, you know, debilitating symptoms, it's just not safe for members of the community to be in there working. How has that affected you?
Man, so I can tell you that there are a lot of people who would choose to take a break right now, who choose to, you know, to take a time out, because they've been stretched way too thin. The analogy that I've heard, I think a very good analogy that I've heard is, hey, so imagine when folks are being in the military, are being deployed, right? They get deployed for 3 months and then they come back home. They're not in a war zone for, come February 28th this year, it'll be 2 years straight. So we don't do that to our military folks, and we shouldn't do that to our medical folks. And it's true in every other industry that people are not stretched thin for this long. They don't have to work as much as they have been the last 2 years, and we need to think of each other in that way. We need to take each other into consideration so much that we protect each other.
Yeah, I really love that. I think that's what you mentioned, you know, us protecting each other and us working towards you know, us, all of us being safe. That's kind of like the reason that I like doing epidemiology and the reason that the field was so interesting to me. My like original plan was to go to medical school after my master's degree, and I wound up not going because I just really liked public health so much, and I really liked the idea that you could work to build a community that keeps itself healthy and happy. You know, I'm not a medical provider, I'm not a doctor. And so I haven't been experiencing the kinds of shifts that a lot of people who work in hospitals have been experiencing. But I think it's worth, like, you know, talking about the reasons that people do have burnout. I don't think that it has that much to do with strength or you know, perseverance. I think pretty much everyone I know who works in a hospital is an incredibly strong person. It's really not as much about strength as it is like not having the resources to cope with the situation. And it's not like, you know, oh, I just can push it a little bit more. I'll find this, you know, strength within myself. You know, at a certain point, that's just not enough. And that's the whole point of public health, is that we have to work together. We have to give people the resources. We have to give ourselves the resources to make sure that we're all safe. We can't just create something out of nothing. And I think that's part of what's happening here.
Dr. Sundaram, if I could step in and say, please don't sell yourself short. You are a doctor. And we have to appreciate and acknowledge that. I mean, what you bring to the table is incredibly invaluable. And I think I heard recently something to the effect that when public health works really well, nobody's supposed to know that it's working. Nobody's supposed to know that it's there, right? And this pandemic has shown us, right, that we have public health folks who are informing our public policy, our public health, and also informing physicians who are not just physicians, but healthcare systems on how to manage this pandemic. So it's, I have to tip my hat off to you and our CDC, OHA, and our count, and our local health, local public health folks.
Absolutely. I agree with you on that, sir. Okay, so there's been a lot of conversation around testing. People can't find tests anywhere. In Florida, though, a million tests expired. There's a, you know, surplus there. There have been talks in New York of trying to decrease the amount of testing. There's a lot of conflict and argument over testing right now, but it does seem like, at least on the local level here, people are concerned. People here in Portland are concerned about, you know, being able to test and making sure they can find, you know, get access to it. How does the testing fit in with the new guidance right now? And what are some of your thoughts on that?
I think for me, the guidance about the isolation, I mean, that's like, you guys might have like talked about this before, maybe not, but I gotta like slip in a cheese analogy here because I'm in Wisconsin. So like, we normally think of like disease prevention as being like, just like imagine like a whole stack, like slices of Swiss cheese kind of set up like dominoes. So like each slice is, you know, it's cheese, but like there are some holes in the cheese. And so like the first slice might be your vaccine. And like that has got maybe like one or two very, very, very small holes. And then the next slice might be like wearing a mask. And that's like a pretty good slice. Also, it's mostly cheese. There's maybe like one or two holes, depending on how you wear your mask, especially, and like what kind of mask it is. And then like there's all these other, you know, slices of Swiss cheese. Like maybe don't go, you know, lick every doorknob in your neighborhood. That's a great slice of Swiss cheese. Don't do that. But one of the really important slices that I think we kind of have been forgetting about is testing. Knowing if you can spread COVID-19 to someone else is a really important piece of information, and it makes people make good decisions. If you don't have a test, you might say, well, I don't know, I probably don't have it, and then like, you know, go and hang out with your grandma, which is not what we want to have happen. Right. You can't just guess if you have COVID-19 or not. If we were good at guessing, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in. So I think this is another example of like, you know, we really need the resources to have people be safe, and we can't ask them to be safe just by guessing, and we can't ask them to be safe just by not having the resources that they need. It's pretty clear to me that like we're having some similar challenges with testing that we originally did with vaccines, where like not everyone can get a test at the same time, which is a bummer. But that means to me like, we should take the same approach that we did with vaccines. They should be highly freely available to the people who are most at risk first. That to me is older adults, healthcare workers, frontline workers. And then also, you know, if we're going to have kids back in school in person, it should be kids too. And that's kind of, you know, my take on it. And again, probably reasonable people might disagree with me on that. But with an eye towards rolling that out for everybody. Because it is like one of those other slices of Swiss cheese that I think is really helpful.
Yeah, I like that analogy. We love cheese here in Portland too, right? So what I will say is that I totally agree that testing is one of those mitigation factors that we have to rely on. And now we have all these at-home tests that are now very, very, very good at catching disease, especially if you're symptomatic, right? So, and that's why it's highly recommended if you've been exposed, you should be testing at about 5 days after the exposure so that you can see whether or not you are infected and are indeed a shedding virus. Because like we talked about in today and in previous episodes, if you have been, you may be, some people who have the virus are asymptomatic, meaning they don't have any symptoms and they may not know that they have the virus and may end up going to hang out with grandma when they're actually infectious and can lead to someone getting very, very sick because they didn't know that they had the virus, right? So get tested if you can. That I do realize that we do have a nationwide shortage, right? Even here in Portland, I'm sure we've all seen the news reports showing empty shelves of at-home tests. And if you go online, try to get a test, it takes forever and ever to for you to end up getting it. So it's very, very important that we all have access to this. And kudos to the Biden administration for coming out and saying that, hey, these should be you should be able to get them through your insurance. Your insurance should be able to pay for these tests.
Yeah. So before we close, one final question. When we have the guidance changing like this, again, there's tons of misinformation out there and people come up with, you know, their theories and you see it on Twitter and you see it on Instagram. There's always, the latest, greatest conspiracy. What are some of the ways that we can address doubts or concerns when the guidance changes, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a tough one. I don't know, Dr. Dubé, you might want to go first.
No, yeah. so here's what we strongly recommend, right? We have experts who do this on a daily basis. People who are in public health, people who have studied this, like yourself, Dr. Sundaram, people who are trusted sources, like your physicians, your healthcare providers, your nurse practitioners, your PAs, who are at the forefront of dealing with this pandemic. We also have very, very reliable information, right, from the CDC, from here in Oregon, we have the Oregon Health Authority and our local public health authorities that have the up-to-date information, that have people who are constantly digesting this information and making sense of it. So it is very, very, very important, very, very important, right, to rely on these trusted sources, to get your information from the right sources. I totally understand. We live in a digital world and Dr. Google knows it all. But Dr. Google is not vetted. So just because you see it online doesn't make it true. Talk to your doctor, talk to your provider, your primary care provider, talk to experts like Dr. Sundaram, who have spent, who have dedicated their lives to understanding these issues and have spent the last 2 years at the forefront of this. Passing it on to you.
Well, that was better than anything I think I could have said. I have like a couple of random thoughts and I'll try to like corral them into some kind of order. So I totally agree with everything you just said. One of the biggest challenges is that historically scientists, and I'll include myself in this, we kind of come across as like being real nerds, real eggheads. It's just not cool to listen to us, and I get it. you know, we all have like these glasses and like funny voices, and I get it. And like, I'm not going to be as funny or engaging or interesting as like Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend's testicles on Twitter. Like, that, I'm just never going to approach that level of charisma, and that is fine. But like, I think the like important thing to note there is that like, it's like a very important and like probably crucial, maybe the most important thing about science, is that you change your mind when you get new information. Mm. And we have been changing our mind about COVID-19 because we keep learning new information. And then that kind of like inspires a question like, well, why did you make up your mind before you had all the information? That's also a very good question. We have to like make a decision sometimes, mm, just because the alternative, not making a decision, dragging your feet, is really damaging. You know, if you have to be right before you move, as Dr. Mike Ryan says from WHO, you know, you're going to be wrong a lot, and you're also going to be stuck still, you know? Mm. So as my dad likes to say, you got to fish or cut bait. We have to make decisions. They're very hard decisions, especially when we know very little, very early on in the pandemic, but we do the best that we can with the data that we have. As soon as we learn something new, we update that information. That means that some things have changed. In the beginning, we said, hey, you know, save the surgical masks for the doctors. Now we have enough surgical masks for everyone. So, that changed. So now we're saying, hey, if you can get a surgical mask, please do that. Or if you can get an N95, please do that, because now we have enough for everybody. We're not worried specifically about doctors not having them. And that's happened with a couple other things too. At first we thought maybe we won't need more than 2 doses of this vaccine. Then we thought, okay, actually maybe a third dose would be really good. There's plenty of other vaccines that have 3 doses in them. That booster dose really seems to provide some longer protection for a lot of the vaccine series that we get, like HPV. Mm. So this is the evidence shows that this is a good way to protect ourselves. I have a friend who was like, you know, when I was like 6, I thought that chocolate milk came from brown cows. And then she like, at some point she like learned that it's not from brown cows, and she changed her mind. And like, that's a really important thing to be able to do, is change your mind. It is very hard, right, but it's important to do. So that's, you're kind of like seeing, you know, scientists update their worldview with new information. I understand like perfectly how frustrating that can be. But every time that happens, I hope people think that like, what we're just doing is trying to make the best decision we have every day with the data that we have.
Right.
Wait, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. You mean chocolate milk doesn't come from brown cows?
I tried my best not to be surprised just now. And kind of now the whole world knows I just found that out.
we'll post the question on Twitter and we'll see what gets the most traction.
Oh, that's going to get scary. That's definitely going to get scary. I know it now. Thank you both so much for everything that you're doing, all these hard hours, these long hours, this, you know, unthinkable work. Thank you so much for that. I do want to let our listeners know there are some vaccine events this coming week and this weekend. Saturday, January 15th at the Rosewood Initiative from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday, January 18th from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Lloyd Center. And then again, Thursday, January 20th from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. So if you need information about vaccines, if you're looking to get a booster shot, there are a couple of opportunities that I just mentioned, and this information will also be down in the comments. Again, thank you both so much for your time. And thank you guys for listening to the episode, and we will catch you next week.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Ask a Black Doctor, airing every Friday at 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. right here on The Numbers. If you missed it, you can find the link to the full episodes on our website at thenumbers.fm. You can also subscribe to the podcast on all streaming platforms. Be sure to rate and leave a comment. If you have questions you'd like answered on future episodes, you can submit them through our website or the link in our bio on Instagram and Twitter.